Hello, good morning, everyone, and thank you for attending today's webinar entitled How to Report IRA Transactions. One of the reasons why we created this webinar is because we've been receiving some common questions clients have in regards to how to report certain transactions that are associated with their IRAs. And some who work with a tax advisor still call us and ask these particular general questions, and might as well create a webinar to answer those questions for at least point you to the right direction in regards to some of these more commonly asked questions about how to report these IRA transactions on your tax return. A little bit of housekeeping before we get started. This seminar, again, is purely for educational purposes. The Entrust Group does not provide investment advice, tax advice, or endorse any products. All information, again, is for educational purposes only. As in any seminar you may find at the Entrust Group, we always and will continue to encourage you to consult with your attorneys, accountants, financial advisors before entering into any type of transaction or investment, as well as any tax concerns that you have, consult with a competent professional. This information is basically just covering the general public information in regards to how to report IRA transactions. Since a lot of you folks don't do this every day, you might as well compile this information. And hopefully this will point you to the right direction as you listen to the information on the seminar. The agenda for today will cover a little bit about the Entrust Group for those of you who are attending the seminar for the first time. Being provided by the Entrust Group. Then we're going to talk about how to report contributions and distributions that occur in an IRA. We'll also take a look at determining taxation for some individuals that have what we call non-deductible contributions made into their traditional IRA, as well as determining how to determine taxation in a Roth. You may be asking, taxation in a Roth, I thought Roths were all tax-free. That's not true. Roth distributions will only be tax-free if the distribution is what we call qualified. And we'll take a look at the criteria that determines what is a qualified distribution in a Roth. However, if a distribution in a Roth is what we call non-qualified, there's still taxation that's involved in that distribution. And that's what we're going to cover today. Next, we're going to cover reporting rollovers. If somebody takes a distribution and decides they didn't want to be taxed on that distribution, well, how do they put it back into the IRA? And how do they report that in their tax return so that the IRS will not will absolve them of the taxation? We'll also take a look at simple IRA as well as SEP IRA account reporting. In other words, where does an individual report this contribution made in their SEP or simple IRA if they're an employer to get the deduction? And last but not least, we'll take a look at another one that's not on the agenda, but it is included in the course. What are additional tax filings that individuals may have to file on behalf of their IRA in regards to incomes that are received by an IRA investment that is considered what we call taxable? The technical term for that is unrelated business income tax, or UBIT. Some people also call it unrelated business taxable income, or UBTI. We'll take a look at the general rules around UBTI or UBIT in regards to investments that are held under retirement plans. And last but not least, we'll open up the phone lines for any questions you may have in regards to the material presented. The presentation will last approximately 45 minutes to 50 minutes long. That's what I'm shooting for. And then we'll open up the phone lines for any questions you may have in regards to the material presented. Now, keep in mind, I will always reserve the right to say, you know, I can't answer that question directly for you, but consult with a tax or legal advisor. Again, my name is John Paul Ruiz, Director of Professional Development at the Entrust Group. And I'll be your moderator or instructor for this particular seminar. About the Entrust Group, we are a self-directed IRA administrator. All IRAs are the same, so don't get confused with the term self-directed. It just means that our platform does not offer any investment, but allows you, the IRA holder, to choose the investment that you choose to hold under your IRA. Unlike broker dealers that offer, you know, securities as in their investment platform, or banks that offer CDs, money market accounts, or insurance companies that offer fixed or variable annuities, the Entrust Group does not offer any investments. But instead, the IRA holder can choose to hold whatever investment they want to hold under their IRA. And of course, the responsibility of looking for the investment, as well as vetting out the investment, is completely the IRA holder's responsibility. That's why we always encourage to incorporate the assistance of a tax or legal advisor before entering into any sort of IRA transaction, because the Entrust Group does not take responsibility of that particular role. It is up to the IRA holder to do that. Our staff is knowledgeable about the IRA rules, and some of them actually carry what we call the Certified IRA Services Professional designation through the American Banking Association. Not only do we educate our staff, but we also educate professionals in the industry, because we do hold a school called the IRA Academy, which is the last bullet point. I kind of jumped a little bit ahead. The IRA Academy is an approved preparatory course for individuals interested in what we call the Certified IRA Services Professional. And it also qualifies for continuing education credits for certain practitioners, such as what we call Certified Financial Planners, Certified Trust Financial Advisors in banks, as well as other compliance office designations. We do have nationwide offices, not in all 50 states, but strategically in certain regions of the United States are what we call brick and mortar offices that we have representatives that, if you're interested in having one of our representatives speak to a group of people about self-direction, we'd be more than happy to engage with you on that. As well as, again, we do provide continuing education programs for multiple designations, as well as, again, in-person events for those interested in gathering a group of people to find out more about self-direction. Now, before we get started with how to report certain things, which we'll start out with contributions, is that let's take a look at the contribution criteria, or the differences between the two different types of IRAs and their eligibility requirements to contribute. All right. For traditional IRA, the taxable compensation is required. Actually, it's for both traditional and Roth IRAs. There is no age limit with the passage of what we call the Secure Act of 2019. Congress removed the age limit for contributing to both a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA. Now, keep in mind, the limits to these two IRAs are combined. In other words, they're shared by both types of IRAs. So if I mention that the contribution limit is $6,000 as an example, well, that $6,000 is shared by both a traditional and a Roth. You can contribute any variations of contributions to either one, but the combined total of contributions made for a particular calendar year cannot exceed that one limit. Now, in a traditional IRA, there is no maximum income limits. In other words, it doesn't matter how much you made for the year, you can still contribute to a traditional IRA. Unlike a traditional IRA in a Roth, Roth IRA contributions are subject to an income limit. In other words, you can't be too rich to contribute to a Roth IRA. We'll take a look at some of those limits in a second. But for both types of IRAs, there is earned income that is required to be received in order for them to be eligible to contribute to either one or both of the IRAs. Now, what is earned income or taxable compensation? Earned income is wages for services performed. In other words, there are certain types of incomes that are not considered earned income. Those incomes are what we call passive income. Let me give you some examples. Rental income, or dividend income, interest income. Those are what we call passive income that is not subject to Social Security tax. However, on the other hand, self-employment income, or W-2 wages, self-employment income from a partnership as an example, those are considered earned income. Now, keep in mind, if you have more questions about that, please consult with your tax advisor in regards to what your situation is to determine whether or not you have earned income or not. Now, in some cases, individuals in a traditional IRA may look for what we call a deduction. The deduction from a traditional IRA is not a given for everybody. The question that they need to answer is, are they covered by an employer-sponsored plan? In other words, if an individual already participates in a 401k plan, as an example, that means they are covered, and now the deductibility of their traditional IRA contribution will be affected. It will be affected by the amount of what we call their modified adjusted gross income. The modified adjusted gross income is the adjusted gross income of an individual with certain things added back, such as foreign earned income housing exclusions, deductions for interest for education, or for some reason it's slipping my mind, for student loans. There you go. That's what I wanted to say. Student loans. There's a list on the IRS Form 1040 in a worksheet that determines the modified adjusted gross income of an individual. That would be a good place to start to determine what the modified adjusted gross income of an individual is. But for the most part, if individuals don't have those additions to be added back to the adjusted gross income, the adjusted gross income of the individual is typically the modified adjusted gross income used for this particular purpose. Let's take a look at a single or head of household filer to illustrate how this works, all right? So in other words, if an individual is going to contribute to a traditional IRA, in other words, they may be too rich to contribute to a Roth, they can still make a contribution to a traditional IRA. However, if they're covered by an employer-sponsored plan, their income will determine whether or not their contribution is deductible in a traditional IRA. And the thresholds are different based on the filing status of an individual. You can either have a single or head of household filer, married couple filing a joint tax return, or in some cases, a married couple may file a separate return because they may receive some tax benefits by separating their income and filing a separate return. All right, let's take a look at a single or head of household filer. If the adjusted gross income or the modified adjusted gross income of an individual who is participating in an employer-sponsored plan is less than $65,000, not only can they make a contribution, they can also use the contribution as a tax deduction. Now, if their income falls between $65,000 and $75,000 for 2020, then their contribution will be a partial deduction. In other words, there's going to be a reduction on what they can use as a tax deduction on their tax return based out of their income. In other words, if their income starts to exceed $65,000, then the amount of deduction that they will get will be dependent upon where they fall between $65,000 and $75,000. If their income falls above $75,000, well, for that individual who is covered by an employer-sponsored plan, they will not be able to use that traditional IRA contribution as a tax deduction. This is just an illustration of what a tax advisor would go through to determine whether or not a contribution is tax deductible or not. Now, you might ask, what happens again at between 65 and 75? A good rule of thumb to eyeball whether how much an individual can deduct is this. For every $1,000 of contribution, every $1,000 of income that exceeds $65,000. So in other words, let's say an individual makes $70,000 for the year. Well, you might ask yourself, self, what does that mean? Well, $70,000 falls between $75,000 and $65,000, or in other words, halfway, or in other words, 50%. What that tells us is whatever the maximum contribution is for the year, that individual can only deduct up to 50% of whatever that amount is. So in other words, if the maximum contribution for an individual is $6,500, or let's say just $6,000 for rounding off purposes, then they can only deduct up to $3,000. In other words, since their income falls above that lower threshold and it gets into that 50% mark, then only 50% of their contribution is deductible. For every $1,000 that goes over 65, it reduces the deductibility by 10%. As you can see, between 65 and 75 is 10. In other words, 10 times 10% would be 100%. So in other words, by the time you get to 75, your contributions are no longer deductible. For a married couple filing a joint tax return, the a phase out range or the income thresholds is between 104 and 124. Below 104, fully deductible. Between 104 and 124, partially deductible. Over 124, no deduction at all is allowed for an individual. Unlike the single or head of household filer, for a married couple filing a joint return, for every 1,000 that goes over the bottom threshold, it reduces their deductibility by 5%. For a married couple filing a separate return, it's almost impossible to get a deduction. They make it really hard. Why? Because they're already getting a tax benefit by filing a separate return. In other words, the married couple filing a separate return is filing that way because they're already getting a tax break for doing such filing. So therefore, Uncle Sam says, if you want a cake, your cake and eat it too, it's going to be a little bit harder because the phase out range or the income threshold is 0 to 10,000. Now let's take a look at the Roth contribution phase out limit. In other words, when you make a contribution to a Roth, what are the eligibility requirements based out of income? Just keep in mind, there is no age limit on a Roth IRA. They must have compensation. However, let's just illustrate for you as an example, a married couple filing a joint tax return. In order for them to contribute to a Roth IRA, their modified adjusted gross income cannot exceed $206,000. What does that mean? If their income is less than $196,000, they can make a full contribution to a Roth IRA. However, if their income starts to exceed $196,000, it reduces their eligibility to make a full Roth contribution for the year. The moment their income exceeds $206,000, well, they're no longer eligible for the Roth. Now, keep in mind, in a traditional IRA, there is no income limit, so they can still make a contribution to a traditional. However, the only thing that they may want to take a look at is, are they covered by an employer-sponsored plan? If they are, chances are they probably won't be able to use that contribution as a tax deduction. It's still not the end of the world. Why is that? In a traditional IRA, if a person makes a contribution and they can't deduct it, they can still make that contribution because keep in mind, the earnings on that contribution will still be growing tax deferred under the traditional IRA. However, if they make a what we call a non-deductible contribution, do you think they might want to track it? In other words, do you think they might want to keep up with the amount that they're making to their traditional IRA that's already been taxed? The answer is absolutely. Common sense will tell us that. Because if they don't track it, when that money is distributed from the traditional IRA, well, it's going to get taxed again. There is an IRS form called an IRS Form 8606. We'll take a look at that form later on in a second as well. In the year, every year that a person makes a contribution to a traditional IRA that is non-deductible, in other words, they didn't use it as a tax deduction, the amount on the IRS Form 8606 is increased by the amount of their non-deductible contribution. So in other words, it's only filed in the year of contribution, as well as it's filed in the year of distribution. So if an individual did not make non-deductible contributions within the last 3 years, but they did make a non-deductible contribution 4 years ago, that's the last time they would have filed the IRS Form 8606. If they choose to make a contribution, let's say prospectively, that 8606 that was filed in a prior year needs to be updated by the current contribution that's being made, that's called a non-deductible contribution. Now, keep in mind, there's a lot of information that I'm throwing out here, but it just hopefully will give you the concept of what a non-deductible contribution is in an IRA and how is that reported in a tax return. As mentioned earlier, contributions in a traditional IRA may be used as an IRA deduction. On the IRS Form 1040, we're seeing 2019, however 2020 looks identically the same, the IRA contributions are reported on line 19 of the individual's Schedule 1, which is an attachment to the IRS Form 1040. The IRA deduction on line 19 will be an amount used to reduce the taxable income of an individual for the year if the IRA contribution is deductible. In other words, as we went through that whole calculation scenario, that if an individual makes a $6,000 contribution, and only $3,000 of the contribution is deductible, this is where the 3,000 is going to show up. Even though an individual makes the full 6,000, some of those non-deductible contributions needs to be tracked. They need to be tracked in what we call an IRS Form 8606. This is what it looks like. Part one of the IRS Form 8606 needs to be completed by anybody who makes a non-deductible contribution to their IRA, because it's like a checkbook. In other words, if they made a $5,000 non-deductible contributions in the past, that's still in the IRA, and they make another $6,000 contribution, or maybe even a $6,500 contribution to their IRA if they're eligible for that amount, well, that $6,500 would need to be added to that $5,000. And that's all done through what we call an IRS Form 8606. Now, keep in mind, again, if you have any questions on your non-deductible contributions, you might want to check with your competent tax or legal advisor, whoever is advising you on your tax returns, to make sure that if you did make a non-deductible contributions in the past, the IRS Form 8606 was filed. Keep in mind, financial institutions do not track non-deductible contributions, because contributions could be made in multiple IRAs throughout the nation. It's up to the taxpayer to keep track of that. Now let's take a look at traditional IRA distribution reporting. When taking a distribution from an IRA or a retirement plan for the matter, distributions are reported on an individual's tax return. Now, how do you find out what, if you took a distribution from an IRA? And there's many things that could happen throughout the year, and you may have forgotten that an amount actually came out of your IRA. Well, I'm gonna assure you that your trustee or custodian will tell the IRS that you took money out. The reporting instrument that is sent to the IRS, as well as the IRA holder or qualified retirement plan or Roth or SEP simple, whatever retirement plan it is, if money's coming out, the IRS Form 1099-R is issued to the IRS as well as the IRA holder. Now, depending upon the amount that is shown on box 7 of the 1099-R will tell you what type of distribution it is. This is just a guide for you to hopefully assist you in as you receive the 1099-Rs that are issued on or before January 31st of 2021. In other words, the end of January, the year following the calendar year. So if you took any distributions in 2020, you will get a 1099-R by January 31st of 2021. And one of these codes will tell you that an amount came out of your IRA. Code 1 means you're under age 59 and a half and is still subject to the 10% penalty. Code 4 means a beneficiary of an IRA holder who passed away took a distribution. Beneficiary distributions are exempt from the 10% penalty. That's why it has a special code. Code 7 is the code for distributions from an IRA holder that has reached age 59 and a half or older. Now, the J, Q, and T are what we call Roth distribution codes. J means the individual has not satisfied the qualified distribution criteria. T means an individual may be 59 and a half, dead, or disabled, but has not satisfied what we call the five-year rule of the qualified distribution criteria. And last but not least, this is what we want on a Roth. The distribution is called qualified. And we'll take a look at what makes a distribution qualified and makes a distribution tax-free. Now, keep in mind, the amount that is distributed has to be reported on the IRS Form 1040 on the individual's tax return. That amount should be reported on line 4A and 4B of the individual's tax return. 4A depicts amounts that are distributed. Now, keep in mind, some of the amounts that are distributed are not taxable. Reason being, the contributions may be non-deductible in distributing assets out of a traditional IRA. Now, keep in mind, anytime you take a distribution out of an IRA, there will always be taxation. Because if an individual who has an IRA or IRAs in aggregate contains both dollars that have been taxed and dollars that have not been taxed, meaning earnings or contributions that were deductible, a portion from each bucket has to come out. In other words, there's always taxation from traditional IRAs, SEPs, SEP IRAs, or simple IRAs. The taxable amount must be reported on line 4B of the IRS Form 1040. Generally, distributions from traditional IRAs, again, are taxable. unless, of course, there's non-deductible contributions, or also known as basis. Basis sitting in an IRA are those dollars that have been taxed already. As mentioned in the previous slide, that if you're going to take money out of a traditional IRA, it contains both dollars that have been taxed and dollars that have not been taxed. A proportionate amount must come out of each bucket. That is what we call the basis recovery rules. I'm going technical on you. And that is all calculated using the IRS Form 8606. You can actually Google that and pull up the IRS Form 8606 to educate yourself a little bit more on the IRS Form 8606 if your IRAs do contain what we call non-deductible contributions. The amount coming out of an IRA, if it's not the whole IRA, must be prorated. The IRS 1099-R reporting codes, again, are code 1, code 4, and code 7. So if a beneficiary is taking a distribution out of a deceased individual's IRA, those distributions might contain what we call non-deductible contributions. It may pay to have a conversation with the executor of that person's estate to determine if previous non-deductible contributions have been made in the past. Here's an example of the proration. As a matter of fact, you can find this regulation under Notice 87-13, which was issued in 1987. Again, the calculation of this proration is facilitated on the IRS Form 8606. To be specific, it's Part 1 of the IRS Form 8606. How does it work? In the illustration to the right of your screen, you'll see that the total year-end balance, that's what the IRS Form 8606 will say. What's the total year-end balance of the individual's IRAs all over the nation? In my example, it's $10,000. However, in the IRS Form 8606, $1,000 have been made, called non-deductible contributions, being tracked on the IRS Form 8606. What that means is that one-tenth of the individual's IRA or IRAs, it consists of non-deductible contributions. If an individual decides to take, let's say, a $1,000 distribution from their IRA, that tells the IRA holder that one-tenth of the distribution is non-taxable because it comes from the basis bucket or the non-deductible contribution basis bucket of their IRAs. In other words, only 900 of that distribution will be taxable. That's essentially how what we call the basis recovery rules work. And that's all calculated using the IRS Form 8606 Part 1. Now, distributions from an IRA could also be subject to a 10% penalty. However, there are exemptions to the 10% penalty that are available under what we call Section 72T of the Internal Revenue Code. If you Google it, you'll find it. All right. What will pop up probably is the Cornell Law Library. And if you take a look at 72, Internal Revenue Code 72, Section T, you'll see the list of exemptions to the 10% penalty. Not all of them apply to IRAs because some of them may apply to what we call qualified retirement plans, such as your 401k plans. But this is a compilation of the exemptions under the IRA world. Let's briefly take a look at it. Attainment of age 59 and a half, of course, is the obvious one. A death, disability, first-time home purchase, medical expenses, health insurance for individuals that are unemployed that want to continue their health insurance coverage called COBRA, IRS levy, qualified reservist, qualified higher education expenses, birth and adoption expenses, which was added by what we call the SECURE Act, qualified disaster relief distributions, such as if you were affected by COVID, you can take up to a distribution of $100,000 from your retirement plans, and the amount is not subject to the 10% penalty. And last but not least, substantial equal periodic distributions called 72T distributions. If an individual qualifies for one of those exemptions, the individual could actually file a form to tell the IRS, hey, IRS, I am not subject to one of those, I'm not subject to the 10% early distribution penalty because I qualify for one of the exemptions. The form used by IRA holders to tell the IRS that they're exempt from a 10% penalty is what we call the IRS Form 5329. On Part 1, Line 2 of that form, the individual could put the code associated with the exemption, and then it's up to the IRS to determine whether or not they say, okay, we accept it, or they might say, prove it. When I say prove it, if it's medical expenses, they might say, prove to me that you have medical expenses. Or if it's disability, They may say, prove to me that you're disabled. Or if it's for first-time home purchase, last example, prove to me, the IRS, that you did use the expenses to purchase a first-time home. Now, keep in mind, again, this is just purely information and general information and what you can use to communicate to the IRS IRA transactions, as well as maybe absolve yourself of the penalties if you do qualify for one of the exemptions. Now, Roth IRA reporting and taxation are all reported on a 1099-R. Now, keep in mind, distributions from a Roth, since we just covered traditional, now let's cover Roth, can either be what we call qualified distributions or non-qualified distribution. Qualified means everything in that Roth IRA is tax-free. Free! In a Roth, non-qualified distributions, something's still going to get taxed, but it does follow what we call the ordering rules. First, let's take a look at a qualified distribution. In order for Roth distributions to be qualified, it has to satisfy two parts to the criteria. It can't just be either one. It has to be both. In other words, if you satisfy the five-year period and have not satisfied one of the four qualifying events, the distribution of the earnings is still taxable. Or vice versa, if you qualify for one of the events and you haven't had a Roth for 5 years, well, the earnings are still taxable. This is what it looks like. The five-year period first means that an individual must have had a Roth, any Roth, for at least 5 years. And by the way, the five-year clock starts as of January 1st of the year for which a contribution is made. So in other words, if a person makes a contribution right now, and this is their first Roth contribution, guess when the clock started? January 1st of this year. See, in other words, if you don't have a Roth, or if you have family members that have earned income and do not have a Roth, what's the moral of the story? Go get one. At least it starts the five-year clock. Now, once the five-year clock is started, keep in mind, the individual must just wait for one of the qualifying events to satisfy the second half of the qualified distribution criteria. In other words, if a person has had a Roth of 5 years and they die, the beneficiaries on that Roth IRA will enjoy the proceeds from that individual's Roth IRA tax-free. If the individual becomes disabled, in other words, they have a very risky job, medical field. An example right now is very risky, a cop, or construction, or whatever it may be that could possibly put this person's health at risk, and they may not be dead, but they're disabled. In other words, they can no longer work. I don't know about you, but I would rather take distributions from my Roth tax-free if an event like that does happen. I came in at 59 and a half. The moment a person is 59 and a half and they've had a Roth for 5 years, all of their Roth IRAs are tax-free for the rest of their lives. First-time home purchase. If somebody wants to take a distribution for first-time home purchase, maybe not even for themselves, but they're going to gift it to a family member who has not owned a principal residence or primary residence 2 years prior to the purchase of one, up to $10,000 of the earnings will be distributed tax-free for first-time home purchase. In other words, not only can they take contributions and possibly conversions that have already been taxed inside a Roth IRA, up to $10,000 of the earnings could be distributed tax-free to purchase their primary residence. The five-year period, again, starts as of January 1st of the year for which a contribution is made. Now, if an individual has not satisfied the qualified distribution criteria, then the distribution is considered what we call non-qualified. Non-qualified means that the distributions from the Roth follows what we call the ordering rules. The ordering rules means that there's a certain order of what comes out of an individual's Roth IRA. In other words, I'm going to add an S to that, Roth IRAs, because Uncle Sam looks at all of an individual's Roth IRAs as one big IRA. Contributions come out first. This is the first line of the order. Contributions come out first. Then, if an individual had converted traditional IRAs to a Roth IRA, or maybe even a qualified retirement plan to a Roth IRA, those are taxed in the year of conversion. Those dollars, since they've been taxed already, are the second line of distributions that occur in a Roth IRA. Contributions come out first, then conversions come out second. Then if an individual still distributes more than the contributions and conversion, Well, the earnings are going to be taxed just like traditional IRAs, subject to tax and a possible penalty on the earnings. Why is that? Because they haven't satisfied the qualified distribution criteria. So what's the moral of the story? Satisfy the qualified distribution criteria and you won't have to worry about taxation on a Roth. But if you haven't satisfied the qualified distribution criteria, still not the end of the world. Let's say you're an individual is really in a pinch. They need some money. Well, touching your Roth IRA still may be a good way to absolve any sort of expense, because if the only amount that they distributed are contributions, then there's no tax, no penalty on that. And if they touch conversions, no tax, but only a possible penalty. But what's the moral of the story? Don't touch your Roth. Why? Because it's the only account that you have that will be tax-free eventually. Now, how does an individual determine the taxation in a non-qualified distribution criteria? Remember that IRS Form 8606? Part 3 of that form walks a client through or walks an IRA holder through determining the taxation. As a matter of fact, take a look at 19. It says, enter the total non-qualified distributions from a Roth IRA. In other words, it's trying to identify the distributions that are to determine what's taxable and not taxable. Let's just put it that way. Part 3 of the IRS Form 8606, again, walks an IRA holder through how to determine taxation in the event of a non-qualified distribution. Roth distribution reporting. We kind of briefly covered this earlier. It is reported under 1099-R, and there are three codes, J, T, and Q. J means you're still jumping through hoops. You haven't satisfied the five-year period and none of the qualifying events. T means an individual has not satisfied the five-year clock, but has met one of the qualifying events. And last but not least, code Q means a qualified distribution, and everything is tax-free. Similar to your traditional IRA, it is also reported on line 4A and 4B of the individual's 1040. Another common question we receive is, how do you report rollovers? How does the IRS know that money that I took out actually came back in? Well, there's going to be a 1099-R, meaning that shows the IRS that money came out, and there should be an offsetting entry into an IRA if it's rolled over. That is what we call the IRS Form 5498. Now, keep in mind, sometimes an individual may take a distribution at the end of the year, which is where we're at right now in 2020. However, the rollover doesn't have to occur until within a 60-day period, which the rollover could occur in 2021. It's still not the end of the world. Why? Because according to the IRS instructions in the IRS Form 1040, which you're seeing on the screen on the top right-hand corner, IRA distributions must still be reported on the 1099-R on line 4A of the individual's tax return. If the amount was rolled over, in other words, if the full amount of the distribution was rolled over, Uncle Sam says, enter zero on line 4B. However, enter rollover next to line 4B so that the IRS knows that the amount was rolled over. So even though the IRS Form 5498 may not be received until subsequent years, the IRS at least knows what the IRA holder did with that particular distribution to absolve themselves from taxation. Now, there are also other types of distributions that may not be taxable to an individual, such as what we call your qualified charitable distributions, as well as HSA funding distributions. Qualified charitable distributions are those distributions that are available to individuals that are over 70 and a half, that basically they're allowed to distribute up to $100,000 per taxpayer. So in other words, if you have a couple that wants to take $100,000 each out of their retirement plans, they're eligible to absolve themselves of taxation as long as those assets are paid directly to a qualified charitable institution. Now, how is that reported to the IRS? Well, it's still reported on line 4A and 4B of the individual's 1040. And if it was a qualified charitable distribution, Uncle Sam says, write in the acronym QCD for qualified charitable distribution. Now, HSA funding distributions are this one-time eligibility for every taxpayer in the nation that qualifies for what we call an HSA. that is called a health savings account, that if they're covered by a high deductible health plan that qualifies the federal criteria, and depending upon whether or not they're covered as a single individual or married or family coverage, that will determine, of course, the maximum contribution for the year. If they don't have any money to put into that HSA, Uncle Sam says, you can take a distribution out of your traditional IRA, because it's the amount that's taxable, a traditional IRA, and contribute that to your HSA, and there will be no taxation on that distribution. In other words, taxation is absolved if the distribution from an IRA is contributed to an HSA to jumpstart that HSA. Now, every taxpayer is only able to do that one time in their lifetime. So in other words, what's the moral of the story? Pick the biggest amount that you can contribute that you qualify for a given year. So in other words, if you have an HSA and you have a family plan, that's the best, because that's the maximum contribution. But nonetheless, qualified charitable distributions and HSA funding distributions are reported also on 4A and 4B of the individual's tax return, QCD or HFD, depending upon the type of distribution that they took, must be beside 4B so that the IRS know what the taxpayer did. I hope that this seminar is helpful for you. Another reporting thing for businesses that establish a retirement plan, and they are what we call self-employed individuals. The self-employed individual contributions for your SEPs, your simples, and individual K contributions are reported on the individual's tax return. The deduction is stated on line 28 of the individual's IRS Form 1040 Schedule 1. That is an amount that is included in all the amounts that will reduce an individual's taxable income for the year. And by the way, I don't have a slide for it, but if you take a look at line 25, that's where the health savings account contributions are reported for individuals who make an out-of-pocket contribution to an HSA. Now, keep in mind, if an HSA contribution is being made through a payroll deduction through what we call a cafeteria plan, you don't have to include that on line 24. But if an individual physically takes money out of their pocket and contributes to an HSA, this is where the straight line deduction comes in for HSA contributions, and that is on line 25. Right? Now, there may be some investments under an individual's IRA that may be taxable. Now, keep in mind, what are those types of investments? If an individual has, let's say, an entity that they invested in, and the income from that entity is what we call trade or business income. In other words, a trade or business held by under an IRA cannot have a competitive advantage over another business outside of an IRA. They can't say, well, I'm going to charge less for this particular service because my taxation is absolved because it's under an IRA. Uncle Sam says that's not fair. So therefore, if trade or business income is received, whether it be outside of an IRA or inside of an IRA, they will be taxed. The taxation that occurs under an entity that has trade or business income under an IRA is taxed at what we call trust tax rates. It's a little bit different taxation rate for entities that are held under what we call a tax-exempt organization. If they have to file taxes, then the IRA would have to file a tax return. That tax return is what we call the IRS Form 990T. So if you have an entity that you own under an IRA, and there has to be what we call a tax return filed, you might want to check with your tax advisor in regards to preparing that form, because that form needs to be filed with the IRS so that the IRA can pay the tax associated with the income it received. If the IRA is going to file a tax return, it also has to acquire its own employer identification number. The custodian will not let you use their employer identification number for that. Why is that? Because each IRA has its own specific tax return. So if a custodian has 1,000 of these IRAs that have a filing, the IRS needs to be able to delineate which IRA filed the specific tax return. That's why an IRA needs to acquire its own EIN. Some of the following types of investments are the ones that are typically associated with what we call UBIT, or unrelated business income tax, or unrelated business taxable income. both are the same. Why? Because if a partnership or an LLC engages in what we call a trade or business type of revenue, well, that income will be subject to taxation. There are other types of incomes that may also produce UBTI. Those are what we call leverage investments. In other words, if an IRA borrowed money to buy a rental property, as an example, in other words, the IRA did not use their own money to buy that rental property, the proportionate share of what the IRA owned, as well as the proportionate share related to the loan to purchase that IRA, will be applied to the income received by that IRA. So in other words, if an individual had 50% in an IRA and 50% was borrowed, the 50% borrowed will represent the percentage of the income received by that IRA as taxable. So in other words, if a rental property was purchased by the IRA and 50% was used to purchase the property was borrowed, then 50% of the income received by that IRA will be taxable to the IRA, therefore will subject the IRA to UBTI filing. And the specific term for the income that is received is what we call UDFI, or unrelated debt finance income. This amount is filed under the IRS Form 990T. If you want to learn more about that, there's a publication called Publication 598. Now, there are some investments that have that may appear to be business income to you that are not subject to UBTI. Those are what we call, as an example, rental property that is purchased outright by IRA funds. The rental income is not taxable. Corporation dividends, rights and royalties, for some example, mineral rights. Disposition of property. So in other words, if an individual bought a piece of property for $100,000 and they sold it for $150,000 in a year, they're flipping that property. The gains on that, if the IRA used all of its funds to purchase the property, the gains is not taxable. That's why some people make a lot more money in an IRA. Why? Because the income is tax deferred. And last but not least, again, leverage investments, however, may be subject to UDFI, unrelated debt finance income, such as rental income, right? Let's give you an example of that. A property held under the produced income, in other words, an income property, rental property. I kind of gave this example already. Ernie purchased income property using his IRA funds, 50% of the purchase price from the IRA and 50% from what we call a non-recourse loan lender. The total monthly income of the property is $2,000. In other words, a total of $24,000 for the year. Well, guess what? $12,000 of the income, generally in simplistic terms, will be subject to what we call UDFI. Again, check with your tax advisor if you do have an investment that has that type of income, because there will be the ones that you will need to connect with, as well as prepare the IRS Form 990T to be filed for your IRA. This is what a 990T looks like. Line 7 of the 990T talks about unrelated debt financed income. That's what we were talking about earlier, all right? Well, that concludes the presentation portion of this particular webinar. Now we're going to open up the phone lines for any questions you may have in regards to the materials presented. Now, keep in mind, again, this is not an all-inclusive seminar for all the tax-related issues dealing with IRA transactions. We just picked the most common questions that our clients have had in regards to these types of topics, and hopefully you found this helpful, at least gets you started in regards to communicating with your tax advisors in this upcoming tax season on what needs to be filed on your tax return, as well as your IRA investment held under a retirement plan. All right, let's open up the phone lines for any questions you may have.
No problem. Question one is, I understand RMDs are not required for 2020. Can you address that?
Yeah, under the question is, are RMDs required in 2020? Because of the COVID issues that our country has been experiencing, the Congress has initiated a postponement, or in other words, absolution of having to take any sort of RMDs in the tax year 2020. It's just as simple as that. A lot of people are already having a hard time. That was the least that Congress could do, was to eliminate RMDs for the tax year 2020.
Great. Next question. What is the deadline for converting a traditional IRA into Roth? Must it be done by December 31st, or can we just do it before April 15th? Or did I read 60 days somewhere?
No, the question is how does a conversion, I'm going to modify the question a little bit. How do you convert for tax year 2020? According to regulation 1.408 big A, which is a treasury regulations dealing with Roth IRAs, the year in which the distribution takes place will determine the year that the conversion is applicable to. So in other words, if an individual converts in wants to convert in 2020, the distribution must have occurred in tax year 2020. If a person processes the distribution by December 31st, as an example, I'm kind of going, you know, extreme here, but on December 31st, if some individual processes a distribution from a traditional IRA, that's the year in which the conversion would count, regardless of when the amount distributed goes into the Roth IRA.
Thank you. Next question. Okay. If I have a checkbook LLC that makes interest, income, capital gains, etc., how would the IRS know if I don't owe taxes for the year since the LLC is part of my IRA?
Now, I'm assuming the question is, I have a checkbook LLC, whatever the checkbook means. A lot of people just put checkbook thing because that's the reason why they set up an LLC, is they wanted to have a checkbook under their IRA. If it's a single member LLC, the incomes that are received by the LLC must be passed on to the IRA. So therefore, the type of income the LLC receives will determine whether or not the IRA has taxation or not. If the LLC receives income that is typically reported on a K-1 that is derived from trade or business, then that tells the individual that they need to file a tax return. Now, keep in mind, in the United States, it's still an honor system of whether or not how an individual declares their income that they received for a particular year. So the question is, how would they know? The only way they would know is that if the individual actually declares that income. If, let's say, the IRS does not know that you received that type of income and the IRA did not file that return for that particular year, the only way they would know that there was income that was taxable for that LLC that is owned by an IRA is in the event of an audit. So for all intents and purposes, if the general manager of the LLC knows that there's trade or business income, they must declare that in order for them not to get into trouble in the event that there was an audit done on that particular LLC. That's how the IRS would know. It's either you tell them or they'll find out in the event of an audit.
Great. Next question. If I transferred money from a rollover IRA account from one institution to Entrust, is it considered a distribution or will I get a 1099-R?
If you have an IRA, whether it be a rollover IRA, because some institutions call it a rollover IRA because it came from a qualified retirement plan, and they moved those dollars from a traditional IRA to a traditional IRA at Entrust, as an example, that is what we call a transfer. As you notice in the presentation, I did not mention or even discuss what we call a transfer, because transfers are non-taxable events. If a transfer between two IRAs occur, there is no 1099-R, so therefore there's no taxation. However, there has to be an agreement between, an unsaid agreement between the two organizations that if it's done as a transfer, there's no reporting for the financial institution that's sending it, as well as the financial institution receiving it. But at the end of the year, the balance will pop up under the new financial institution, which would be showing up on what we call an IRS Form 5498. To answer the question, IRA to IRA is what we call a transfer. There's no taxation. There's no reporting.
Thank you. Next question. If I did not max out my company's 401k and only put 8,000, having made 120k, can I contribute the remainder to my self-directed IRA?
Okay, the question is, if I didn't max out my contribution for my 401k plan, can I make the remainder portion to a traditional IRA? The answer, number one, first, is that the contribution eligibility in a Roth IRA, or the maximums in a Roth, in a 401k plan, has no correlation to the maximum amount you can contribute to an IRA. So let's say the maximum contribution to a 401k plan is $19,000, and the maximum contribution to a traditional IRA, let's say, is $6,000. Those two are completely separate. However, to answer your question, if you didn't max out your contribution to a 401k plan and you have additional cash that you want to contribute to a traditional IRA, as long as you have not made the full maximum statutory limit for a traditional IRA, then the contribution should be okay.
Okay, thank you. Next question. May I still file 8606 forms for traditional non-deductible contributions, which my CPA and I forgot to file, say, 10 to 15 years ago? If so, where can I find this old year 8606?
Okay, there are several questions, the multi-layered question on that question. Can you file an 8606 that was not filed in previous years? The answer is, typically, the IRS only goes back as far as 3 years in regards to tax filings that have not been filed. But it wouldn't hurt to try, because the worst thing, the only thing, depending upon the office that receives the form, is that they could possibly reject it. All right. How do you get old 8606? I would request it from the IRS. I don't know how long the IRS hangs on to forms these days. It used to be 15 years that they would hang on to a paper tax return, but the IRS has gone through a revamping of how they archive returns. Even though 15 years has passed the statutory limit, sometimes they still may have it. I would just check with the Internal Revenue Service in regards to acquiring previous year's tax returns to acquire that 8606 if it was filed in that particular year. They don't hang on to documents very long, but if you're one of those people that they haven't electronically document imaged, as an example, your tax return, then you may still be able to get it. There is no guarantee. There is no rules around that. I would call the Internal Revenue Service, however, if you're interested in acquiring those past 8606s.
Great, thank you. And the next question is very, very similar. So Tang, please let me know if the last response did not answer your question. JP, it's very similar to what kind of do I and can I file amended returns over 10 years ago, you know, for contributions that are very old. So we'll move on.
Yeah, amended returns can only go back as far as 3 years, which is what we call the IRS Form 1040X. But if it's an IRS Form 8606 that makes a declaration of a contribution that's non-deductible, again, it wouldn't hurt to try and file with the IRS to keep track of your basis, because you don't want to be taxed on those dollars again. But generally, you can only file amended returns as far back as 3 years.
Great. Thank you for that extra detail. All right, next question. How will a traditional IRA be taxed if I have not paid any salary-based tax for the last 5 years, but I have had passive income from rental property that has still resulted in zero tax owed?
Okay, so if somebody takes a distribution from a traditional, could you repeat the question again?
Yeah, I'll try to restructure here. So if have not paid any salary-based tax for the past 5 years, but have passive income from a rental property that still didn't result in tax owed, how will a traditional IRA be taxed?
Okay, let's answer your question first. If you have passive income and no earned income, then that's completely separate. I mean, the earned income is just for eligibility to make a contribution. IRA dollars, however, are taxable in the year that it's distributed. So if you have a traditional IRA and you take a distribution from a traditional IRA, that is taxed in the year it's distributed, includable in taxable income on line 7 or the new line on the IRS form 1040. It used to be line 7 in the old 1040s, but it should be includable as taxable income. Those are really two completely separate pieces of information within the same question. Again, earned income is only a criteria to determine eligibility to make a contribution. It has no bearing on the taxation of a distribution.
Okay, thank you. Nick, let us know if that covered your question, or if not, we can follow up. Next question. So one person pointed out that we had a small error in our deck, but JP, I can cover that with you afterwards. Sure. I need to jump back now. Next question. If one took a distribution from my IRA and want to claim the COVID exemption, is there a particular IRS form that should be filled out?
So if an individual wants to take a distribution due to COVID, which actually falls under what we call a qualified natural disaster distribution, the individual would need to file, number one, a 5329 to tell the IRS that the distribution is due to COVID and that it is exempt from the 10% penalty. One of the criteria for taxation of the $100,000 limit for COVID is the fact that an individual must also file what we call an IRS Form 8915E. The reason for that is the taxation of the $100,000 could be ratably prorated for 3 years. In other words, you don't have to pay the tax on the full $100,000 in the year of distribution. You could, however, if you wanted to. However, Uncle Sam allows for an individual who took that $100,000 distribution due to COVID hardship to spread out the taxation to 3 years. In other words, $30,000 for each one of the years, right? So mm-hmm. that IRS Form 8915E will be the form used to declare to Uncle Sam the taxation of the $100,000 or maximum $100,000 distribution. An individual could also take less than $100,000 if they wanted to. And that IRS Form 8915E will be the form that is filed on an individual's tax return to report the COVID-related distribution.
Thank you. And we got some clarification from Nick. Thank you for clarifying on that question. He restructured to make it more clear on what he was getting at. So he meant if I've been paying zero tax in parentheses after all the deduction and write-offs for the past 5 years, how much tax would I owe when I make a distribution eventually from that traditional IRA?
Okay. So basically, the only thing I'm going to be answering for you is how much tax would you owe on a particular IRA distribution? And the answer is, I don't know. The reason for that is, I don't know where you're going to take it out. And number two, depending upon the taxation rules for that particular year will dictate the taxation of a particular distribution done in a particular year. Currently, right now, based on the tax rates, we have a reduction in tax rates due to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. If you take a distribution 10 years from now, and we don't know who's in power, we don't know how they're going to view taxation or the brackets, or I don't even know how we're going to be taxed 10 years from now. Again, depending upon how Congress looks at how income is taxed. So to answer that question, I don't know, because I don't know where you're going to distribute it, as well as what the tax rules are at that time. It is best to seek the assistance of a competent tax advisor so that they can walk you the tax rules for that year's distribution. Because keep in mind, again, there are certain reductions in other incomes or incomes in total. You may have wages for services performed. You may have capital gains sold from other properties. And those have to be put in consideration to determine the level of taxation or level of income is received for the year, as well as the level of taxation for that particular year. So again, the answer would be, I wouldn't know, because it's not a flat rate. We work on a bracket system.
Got it. One person posed a thought based on this, saying they think his question is the fact that he received $0 tax deduction when he made the contribution to the IRA.
Oh, so if the question was, if an individual made a contribution to a traditional IRA, that is what we call a non-deductible contribution, then those dollars would have been taxed already. If those dollars have been taxed already and being tracked on an IRS Form 8606, the portion that's distributed from that bucket will not be taxed at all. You know, that's why the 8606 is very important, because you don't want to be double taxed on a contribution made to a traditional IRA that was not used as a tax deduction.
Great. Thank you for clearing that up. And thank you again, Lee. That was helpful.
Thank you for the clarification of the question.
Great. Moving on. Next question. Are there any COVID-related tax advantages for withdrawals from traditional IRAs?
Well, the COVID-related tax advantages are an individual can take up to $100,000 from any taxable retirement plan, and the amount will not be subject to the 10% penalty because it's COVID-related. It's part of the exemptions under Section 72T of the Internal Revenue Code that was associated with disaster relief, and COVID is treated as one of those. One of the advantages is that instead of being taxed on the full on the amount distributed in a particular tax year, the distributed amount could be spread out. The taxation and the distribution could be spread out up to 3 years, and that's where that IRS Form 8915 comes in. So those are the two tax benefits: exempt from the 10% penalty, taxation could be spread out for 3 years, and another benefit is, I forgot to mention, is that those amounts can be repaid back, or in other words, rolled back into the IRA. If they come up with a money that was distributed and they didn't need it, those could be repaid back, and those amounts will, whatever amount was rolled back in or repaid back in, will eliminate taxation on that portion. And that's why the 8915 is an essential form to declare to the IRS that you took money out. And if you did put it back in, that's also captured on the IRS Form 89-15E.
And somebody's two quick follow-ups on that are, when does the COVID withdrawal option end?
The COVID withdrawal option does not have a time frame at this point, because they don't know when the COVID pandemic is going to end. So there is no prescribed deadline for that. So, but be aware that the year in which the distribution takes place determines the year in which the taxation takes place. So if you're going to take it this year, well, then it's going to be, a portion of that's going to be taxable this year. But if they wait until next year, then it falls under the taxation for next year. And we don't know what the, tax rules would be next year, of course, with the election happening right now with new people in Congress coming in. We don't know if they're going to change the taxation in 2021.
Thank you. And then, is that also applicable, JP, for every self-directed IRA that buys real estate with borrowed funds?
It applies to all retirement plans, regardless of the investment. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to the next question. Will the K-1 report the income from trade or business to calculate UBIT?
Yes. In a K-1 received by an IRA from a general manager of an LLC, as an example, it's the line that says trade or business income is typically the amount that is used to calculate UB, unrelated business taxable income. There are other lines on that K-1 that may not be subject to UBTI, such as interest, dividends, or rental income. Those lines are not included in calculating UBTI or UBIT. That's why it's good to know on publication 598 is where they outline all of it on the types of incomes that are subject to UBTI and incomes that are not subject to UBTI.
Great, thank you. Next question. When opening an SDIRA, will EIN, Employer Identification Number, be automatically assigned or need to be requested from the IRS?
The question was, is an EIN automatically assigned? The answer is no, it's not automatically assigned, because some investments do not need an EIN because it doesn't file a tax return. However, if the IRA holder who's responsible to understand the rules about alternative investments that could subject the IRA to tax filings must acquire an EIN if there is a tax filing that needs to be filed for the individual retirement arrangement based on an investment that they invested in. So it's not always the custodians will not assign an EIN when cannot assign an EIN. It's only the IRS that basically does that.
Great. So they would have to then request that themselves, right?
Correct. And the form that is acquired by the individual to acquire the EIN is what we call the IRS form SS4. The SS4 could actually be completed online, and the IRS responds fairly quickly in regards to EIN requests, because they want that filing to be done. So.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, next question. How do you take income from a rental property as a distribution? Do you have to run the revenue back through the entrust group, or can you take the distribution and report it on your own taxes?
So the question is, how do you report rental income?
How do you take income from a rental property, like receive, not report?
How do you receive rental income from a property held under an IRA, I would assume? And I would also assume that this rental property is under an LLC, because most of the time when an IRA owns a piece of property directly as rental income, the rental income actually goes back into an IRA. I'm assuming that this is owned by an LLC, which
Correct.
The custodian is not aware that the rental income is coming in.
Yeah, Daniel,
if rental income
it's
is
an LLC.
Okay. If rental income is received by an LLC that is owned by an IRA, the best way to handle it, to make sure that they don't circumvent taxation and get into trouble with the IRS, is the assets must be sent back to the custodian for the custodian to process the distribution so that the 1099-R is issued. If assets are unfortunately paid directly to the IRA holder without going through the custodian, the IRA holder could file what we call an IRS Form 4852. The IRS Form 4852 is somewhat of a form used by IRA holders to create their own 1099-R in regards to that particular distribution. Now, keep in mind, the IRS frowns on it. The reason for that is because, number one, there are what we call withholding rules in IRA distributions that did not occur in that particular distribution. Under Section 3405 of the code, the distribution must have 10% withheld on every distribution unless the IRA holder waives it affirmatively, in other words, in writing. That did not occur. So, you know, to answer your question, generally, if it's done right, assets in an LLC, since it's owned by the IRA, must go back to the custodian so that the custodian can process the proper reporting. However, if it's already happened, the custodian is not going to report that on the 1099-R, because the auditors will frown on that, because they're saying, how could you cut a 1099-R when assets were never received? That could be a violation of processing and audit trails and whatnot. If the amount was actually paid to the IRA holder, the IRS Form 4852, which is typically used to dispute dollar figures on a 1099-R reported by any payee, I mean, not payee, but payor, could also be used to declare income received by a taxpayer that was not issued on a, that was not reported on a 1099-R. So I gave you two answers. One is the proper way of doing it. The other one is kind of after the fact way of correcting it.
Great, thank you. Next question. How do you show a loss in your account attributed to COVID? For example, lost contracts to the LLC.
How do you show loss? Unfortunately, if it's an IRA, gains and losses are all suppressed under an IRA-owned investment. So that will be something that you might want to check with your tax advisor on how they're declaring that information, because we don't know, I don't know if there's any other investors in that LLC as well that could possibly use that as a loss on their own individual tax return if it's owned by an individual. But IRA-owned types of investments, gains and losses are all suppressed. So,
got it. Thank you.
That'll be a tax question for a tax advisor.
Mm-hmm. Next question. If I utilize a self-directed IRA to purchase real estate for rental purposes, for example, does the monthly income off of that have to go back into the IRA, or can I use that actual income? I think we covered this a bit before.
Well, any type of income received by an IRA investment must stay under the umbrella of the IRA in order for it to be tax deferred. Assets that are used by an individual earned by a piece of investment under an IRA is called a distribution, and therefore that amount should be taxable generally.
Great, thank you. Next question. If my IRA and Roth IRA partner together on a property 50-50 and the property earned $10,000 in rental income, Julie, I'm seeing the second part of this. So I'm going to repeat this. So essentially, if I partner my traditional and Roth on a property 50-50 and it was earning $10,000 in rental income, would I be able to apply $6,000 to my Roth and $4,000 to the traditional, or does it have to be split per the original invested percentages?
To answer your question right away, it has to be split according to the ownership percentage.
Okay.
By artificially inflating one IRA one IRA over another could be a violation. And the reason for that is any proceeds that are, in other words, self-dealing, let's just put it that way. You apportion income disproportionately to an IRA investment that is owned by your IRA. And that would not be something that I would do. It would have to be proportionate. If it's 50-50, income and expenses have to be either received or paid directly from each IRA proportionately.
Thank you. Great question, Julie.
Great question.
All right, next question. I do not have earned income, but my husband does. Am I able to invest in an IRA based on my husband's earned income?
That's a good question. When you say invest, I'm assuming, can I contribute to an IRA if I don't have earned income and my husband has earned income?
Correct.
And the answer is, it depends upon how you file your taxes. If you're a married couple filing a joint tax return, that's the best scenario, because Uncle Sam says, I don't care who earned the money. As long as you are a married couple filing a joint tax return, all incomes earned by either one is earned by both, which means now you have earned income to contribute to an IRA if the couple's income is enough to support the threshold of what you're contributing.
Great, thank you.
Again, the key here is married couple filing a joint tax return.
Okay, next question. I have an IRA that is invested in another company. My share is 75%. The other partner is 25%. Do I owe taxes on my earnings?
Well, it depends upon the question is 75% owns a company owned by the IRA. Depends upon the income that is earned from that company. Is it trade or business income, or is it interest income? If it's trade or business income owned from that company, then that income received by the IRA could be subject to the unrelated business taxable income. I would highly recommend for the tax advisor to take a look at that income being declared as received from that business that the IRA invested in, on what type of income it is, to determine whether or not it's subject to taxation.
Great, thank you. Next question. What form is used to report interest paid on a loan taken from investment, or sorry, for investment?
What form is used to report the interest paid
on a loan taken for investment?
On a loan. So in other words, an IRA borrowed money using what we call a non-recourse loan. I'm assuming that's the question.
Yeah, that's what I'm gathering here. Adam, correct me if we're wrong, but roll
okay.
with that.
If you take a look at the 990T, there's income and expenses. And that form 990T should include the earnings as part of the I wouldn't say profit and loss, as far as the numbers for that particular piece of property. It should be part of that 990T filing. So the 990T, take a look at the 990T filing, similar to an individual tax return 1040. It just so happens that the person filing or the individual or entity filing the tax return is not an individual, but an IRA. That would be the 990T. So there are lines on the 990T. If you pull it up, it should tell you, you know, where the expenses should be or interest that are paid that are from the property that is leveraged or holds a non-recourse loan, as an example. That's where it'll pop up.
Thank you, JP. Follow up quickly from Adam. Is it the same form if the loan taken is not in an IRA?
I'm lost there. So
essentially, if you're reporting so if you have a loan that's outside of an IRA that's earning, like they were mentioning in the last example, but again, it's just not retirement plan related.
We can't answer. I mean, I would suggest to talk to your tax advisor on that
Great.
Piece if it's not retirement plan related.
Great, thank you. All right, next question. When will we get our 2020 distributions tax form from the Entrust Group?
The 2020 distributions on what we call an IRS Form 1099-R has a deadline of January 31st of 2021. So in other words, the custodian, in this case, the Entrust Group, has 31 days to prepare that IRS Form 1099-R. Most of the time, we don't wait until, you know, January 31st, if we have prepared the form earlier, we may send that earlier. But the ultimate deadline that the IRS prescribes for 1099-R is January 31st of the year following the calendar year. So it should be coming out shortly. So if you call us between January 1st and January 31st, and the waiting time may be a little bit longer, that's the reason why, because we're preparing all the tax forms required by the IRS on our IRA program.
Thank you, JP. Next question. For a metals IRA distribution, how is the value to be charged achieved?
The fair market value, the question is, in a metals distribution, in other words, an in-kind distribution, I'm assuming that's the question. Is that correct?
I was just going to follow up. So they said, how is the value of tax achieved? Is it with the value of the metals purchase price? Or is it the spot value on the day of the distribution?
The answer is it's a spot or the fair market value during the date of the distribution, which the dealer is the one that determines whatever that value is at that point that is reported leaving the account. As it leaves the account, whatever the fair market value is at that point is the amount that's reported. Because if you purchase it at $50, now it's worth $150 at the time of the distribution, the fair market value will be the amount that will show up as taxable income for the year for that distribution.
Great, thank you. Next question. If I receive a distribution, how do I put it back into my traditional IRA?
If somebody receives a distribution, you can put it back as long as it's within a 60-day period. 60 days start from the day after constructive receipt. So in other words, if you receive the distribution today, day one is tomorrow. the rollover or the distribution that's being put back in can be placed back in by coming to an institution like the Entrust Group or Edward Jones, or I don't know what type of investment you distributed. If it's being rolled over in cash, you can go to any IRA provider that of the same type of IRA and roll that money back in as long as it's within 60 days. Most, if not all, custodians and trustees will try to intervene and have you answer certain questions, such as, has it been more than 60 days since you took the distribution? They will have you fill out what we call a rollover certification form. Depending upon how you answer that form will determine whether or not the custodian can actually accept that amount that you distributed. If you put it back in within a 60-day period and you put on line 4A the amount distributed and on 4B the total of the amount that was not taxable because you rolled it over, then that will tell the IRS on your IRS form 1040, I took money out, but there's no taxation because I put it back in. And then the 1099-R, which is the tax reporting instrument issued by the IRS, shows money coming out. And the 5498, which is the reporting instrument that shows money coming back in, will report the amount that came back in on box 2 of that 5498 as the offsetting entry. So the tax forms must match, as well as the IRS form 1040 must also reflect what the tax forms report. And that's how you do what we call a rollover or putting back money that was previously distributed. I hope that helps. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Just a quick update. Back on the last question. I'm talking about the metals. So Chris added, okay. Due to the market fluctuation in a gold distribution from my traditional IRA, and since it took so long to receive it after requesting it, the market value increased significantly, and now I may have a large tax problem at the end of the year. Is it possible to use the 8915 for coronavirus to spread it across 3 years? As due to the coronavirus, we decided to get the gold back in hand.
If the distribution was due to coronavirus, in other words, if you were actually eligible to take the distribution for coronavirus purposes, in other words, you were affected by the coronavirus, you were actually diagnosed with the coronavirus or a family member. There's a certain set of criteria that determines whether or not an individual can actually avail of the coronavirus exemption. And absolutely, of course, you could actually use that distribution and as a means of putting that money back as well. I mean, if you take a distribution, you can roll that money back within 60 days. I mean, that's not a, you know, to absolve the taxation, the higher value of the particular investment. Number one, again, if you want to use the coronavirus, you have to be eligible for it. But if you did take a distribution, you don't want to pay taxes on it. There is a means of putting it back in within 60 days to absolve the taxation. Now, keep in mind, when you do a rollover, you can only do one of those in a 12-month period. So, choose wisely what your options are. Number one, you have to be eligible for it. And number two, you have options. Discuss with your tax advisor what your best option is.
Great. Chris, let us know if that cleared it up. He said 60 days has already passed. I took it about 6 weeks, or it took about 6 weeks to get the gold.
Yeah, but if you're eligible for the COVID relief, there is a set of criteria that that depicts who's eligible. Yeah, and absolutely. And that's if it's allowable by law, absolutely. If you qualify for it, you can definitely do that. Because yeah, the tax returns have not been filed for 2020.
Great. Cool. He said thanks. Thank you for clearing that up, JP.
Yes.
All right. Next question.
I hope this is helpful for people.
Plenty are staying along with us for this lengthy ride, so I think it is very helpful. Next question. So about FMV, if the retirement account has 1,000 in rental income added to the value of the account, do you have to find an FMV each year or only when the property that is generating an income is sold? So essentially, is FMV required annually or just at time of sale?
FMV is required on an annual basis. Unfortunately, that's a requirement under the Treasury regulations. When IRAs were created in 74, the first one to be established was in 75. The increase in value of a property is not just the purchase price. Keep in mind, if it's a property, properties, you know, increase in value based on the equity that is earned as a, an appreciation or depreciation. So that amount is reported on the fair market value, reflected on the fair market value, not just the income as well. So if a value, if a property may be a piece of land that's empty, let's say a lake lot that may be worth $55,000 this year, and all of a sudden everybody wanted to, a lake lot, now it's worth $150,000. The increase in value of that property must also be reflected on the fair market value. That's why there are parameters that custodians require from IRA holders on how they came up with the value of a piece of property, because it's required by the IRS. And custodians are held accountable to report not only the amount, but the correct amount. So the appreciation of the value of the property must be reflected as well, not only the income.
Great. Next question. Can I roll over money from a separate 401k into my entrust account, then use those funds to pay off my mortgage loan on property held in custodianship by entrust without being taxed? Let me know if you need me.
I'm assuming that the IRA has a non-recourse loan and you want to roll over your 401k into a traditional IRA is an example of the entrust group and used out those proceeds to pay off a non-recourse loan. The answer is yes, without paying tax.
And then they had a follow-up on, do you pay taxes on money transferred or rolled over from traditional to Roth?
Money's being moved from a traditional to Roth via what we call a conversion. In other words, it's our dollars in an IRA that has been contributed in the past, and it just so happens that you go, I like that Roth, I want to move it to a Roth. Conversions are always taxable. So in other words, to answer your questions, yes, it is taxable. But regardless of how old an individual is that does a conversion, the 10% penalty is absolved for any age as a way of enticing people to convert their traditional IRAs to Roth. Because keep in mind, you know, the government always wants immediate taxation on retirement plans. So if you convert, well, then there's taxation there, but as an incentive, they waive the 10% penalty.
Thank you. Next question. If I have a UBIT loss for the year, can this loss be applied to next year's UBIT profits?
That would be a question for a tax advisor. Since it's specific to your particular investment, I would check with your tax advisor.
Okay. Next question. Do distributions from real estate investments through crowdfunded LLCs, are they subject to UBIT?
Are crowdfunded LLCs subject to UBIT? The answer is it depends. It depends upon what type of income the LLC gives back in the K-1s for those particular types of investments. If it's interest income, well, then there's not subject to UBIT. So again, if it's a trade or business income, it will be subject to UBIT. If it's an LLC that owns pieces of real estate that receives rental income and it's passed on to the IRA holders as rental income, not subject to UBIT. So it really depends upon the income that is declared by the investment organization that's being passed back on to the IRA. If it's trade or business income, again, it's subject to UBIT. But if it's or if it's a leveraged income, in other words, the LLC got a non-recourse loan based on amounts used to fund the LLC, then the portion that is attributable to the loan will be applied to the income received, and that portion could be subject to UBIT. So it really depends upon the type of income that is reflected on that K-1.
Okay, thank you. We have a follow-up on the FMV question, JP, with some more detail from Julie. So I'm going to run you through the add-ons here. So my retirement plan purchased a property. Property earns $20,000 each year from rental. So the original investment increases each year from the income increasement, but the property is not being sold. In other words, 1 year it's worth 100, the next year it's worth 120, so on and so forth. So they were again asking if they had to file annually, and they were asking because they've been told that if there's no sell or no sale of the property, that they wouldn't have to do that. So can you please set them straight on if the increase in the account only comes from rental income, would they still have to do that FMV annually?
Technically you do, because the piece of property, unless it remains flat in its value, right, then the only increase would be the rental income coming in. But if the property appreciates in value, that is includable, that is a factor that will increase the fair market value of the IRA. The fair market value of an IRA is defined by the IRS, used for many, many different purposes, is what a willing buyer would purchase a piece of property sold by a willing seller without any sort of coercion or in other words, there's no artificial inflating or deflating of the property. So what would it sell for at December 31st? So it's not just the income that is reported. The fair market value also includes the appreciation of the property. And that's why custodians have to ask for that fair market value every year, because the IRS wants to know the value on IRA investments in total. Because that's passed on to Congress to determine whether or not the legislations that they're doing is working, regardless of whether or not the investment has sold or not sold. Let's put it this way: if an IRA bought IBM stock, which is property as well, was worth $100 today, it had a dividend of $15. However, the stock is worth $200 by December 31st. The fair market value of that IBM stock will not remain at $100. It'll be at $200 reported as part of the fair market value statement on that IRA, including the dividend, because the dividend would have increased and bought more shares for that particular stock. So in other words, just because the property was not sold, the earnings or the growth in that particular investment is still reported on the fair market value. Now, keep in mind, the fair market value is not reportable as taxable to the IRA. It's just an annual reporting to the IRS, which is then passed on to Congress on the values of investments and their retirement plans. And that's why custodians ask for the fair market value at the end of the year.
So, yeah, and if I may, JP, I think their confusion I think might stem from kind of, since there's no company that changes that value for them or provides that number, what would be the most common strategy that you would employ annually? Would you, get an appraiser yourself, or how would you go about that, just so they have a practical takeaway on how to execute?
Sure. Most custodians provide, of course, an appraisal would be the most prudent way of getting the fair market value, but it's also not cost effective.
Right.
So
right.
Most custodians, to avoid impractical requirements from the IRA holder, require other means of getting a value for that particular property. Maybe a tax assessment, from the assessor's office of the value of that property that's used to base the property tax associated for the particular property may be accepted by custodians. Custodians could also accept a fair market value evaluation from a credible broker in the area based on comparables within the area. Those are just two examples of alternative methods of providing a fair market value instead of getting an appraisal, which is not costly at all. I mean, a property tax bill should incorporate an assessed appraised value by the city for what the value of the particular investment is without any sort of cost at all. So in some cases, are acceptable to custodians.
And then is there a penalty, JP, if you do not report an FMV each year?
There is no penalty, but it could be something that they would scrutinize, because Article 5, in the event of an audit, even though there's no wrongdoing done, it could be cause for the IRS to look at it. Because why did you not give a fair market value when it did change? In some cases, the fair market value could affect the required minimum distribution calculation of an IRA, as an example. And if no new fair market value was provided, it could skew the calculation. Now, keep in mind, Article 5 of the IRA document says that the grantor of an IRA is responsible to provide the necessary report so that the custodian can satisfy their reporting requirements. And that's why the custodian is asking for that information. But as far as the penalty, there is no automatic penalty for the IRA holder. But it could be cause for people to not people, but the IRS to scrutinize something in the event of an audit.
Got it. So it wouldn't trigger an audit, but if you were being audited and they saw that, it might raise suspicion or it might cause further scrutiny. Okay. Let us know if that covers your question, Adam.
Because what's the point of hiding the actual value of the property where there's no taxation? So.
Great. Okay. That covers that. Okay. Next question. So although the webinar is not about Checkbook LLC, it was brought up earlier and Lee was wondering if you could just give us a working definition of what checkbook control is within an LLC.
A checkbook control within an LLC is a marketing term more than anything. We don't market it at all, but we do accept it if the client is comfortable with it. Keep in mind, IRAs cannot have a checkbook because it's a retirement plan. So to circumvent that, certain institutions offering IRAs out there as a marketing scheme offer the fact that, you know, or say the fact that based on a case called the Swanson case, which was a poorly argued case by the Internal Revenue Service, said, number one, you can open up a brand new LLC, put yourself as the IRA holder as the general manager of that LLC, and given the fact that the LLC is funded by the IRA, then the only owner of that LLC is the IRA. You could call it the single member LLC IRA owned by the IRA. Now keep in mind, since IRAs cannot have a checkbook, LLCs can. So LLCs in turn could open up a checking account at a local bank, as an example, under the LLC's name. Some individuals would use the custodian's EIN, which you shouldn't be doing that because the LLC is not the custodian. The LLC is a completely separate entity that the IRA invested in. So it should actually get its own EIN. So it should be used to report any income from that, you know, LLC, if there are any reportable income for that LLC. LLCs are touted out there for people who create the document. Of course, they get paid a small fee for it. That, you know, it should limit the liability of the IRA holder. Well, that goes beyond our the scheme of what we do. So if some people want to open up an LLC for that, they would need to consult their legal advisor. Another reason why some people set up an LLC is to reduce the fees associated with owning alternative assets under an IRA. As an example, most custodians out there, depending upon the number of investments that you have under your IRA, will also determine the size of your fees. If they choose on a per asset basis, let's say it's $300 that is charged by the custodian for record keeping fees. If you have 10 houses there, well, they're multiply 300 by 10. However, if the IRA funded an LLC and the LLC purchased properties, according to the books of the custodian, there's only one investment. So therefore, from a record keeping fee, it could save the IRA holder, could be a substantial amount of record keeping fees. But for all intents and purposes, a checkbook control LLC just means that an IRA invests in an LLC, and the LLC being an entity can establish its own checking account, which gives a little bit more flexibility for the IRA holder to quickly move on a particular investment, as an example. Because if the checkbook has the assets funded by the IRA, they can move quickly in auctions, so on and so forth. I believe the drawback for that, however, is that if the general manager of the LLC is not knowledgeable about the IRA rules, they could make a distribution to themselves, as an example, by cutting a check to themselves, and the custodian's not going to know that. So, I mean, although the custodian is not liable for the actions of the general manager, it could be somewhat of an issue for the IRA holder when things like that happens. Or, given the fact that it's an arm's length transaction for the record keeper, which the record keeper or IRA administrator is not necessarily a fiduciary of the account, the LLC, the actions or activities engaged by the LLC could also be, could also cross the line of a prohibited transaction. So to answer your question, all a checkbook control LLC is an IRA invests in an entity. The entity can actually, establish its checking account. Since the money is within the entity, it gives flexibility for the general manager to act quickly as well as reduce certain fees. But beyond that, checkbook control LLCs still fall under the same rules and regulations, just like any other IRA. And they just need to be aware of what the rules are to make sure that it doesn't cross that line, that in the event of an audit, the IRS doesn't find anything derogatory in the transactions that have occurred.
Thank you. A couple more questions here. So for PWCG, I'm not sure exactly what that is. For PWCG traditional IRAs that are being distributed starting in 2021, and the distribution is being done by the receiver's agent, not requested by the owner, will there be 1099 forms filed? And can one just use 5498 forms if the rollover to a traditional IRA is at another institution?
Could you explain what PWGC is?
Margo, if you're still on, I'm seeing you are. Could you please let us know what PWCG is, and we can respond more accurately? We'll move on while they type that in. So last year, I did a rollover simple IRA to Roth within trust. I had not filed an 8606 in prior years, but had non-deductible contributions to the simple. When filing my return, I entered the appropriate basis and paid tax only on the taxable amount. Should I file Form 8606 for those prior years? What scenario would I have a penalty for not filing? Would there be an audit, or would I just potentially lose the ability to have tax-free gains in my new Roth?
The Roth piece is not an issue. The issue is, okay, so the 8606 for prior years should have been all wrapped up with the 8606 for the year of conversion. So in other words, you don't have a completely separate standalone 8606 for prior years. Whatever the total amount is of non-deductible contributions used to determine the taxation in the year of conversion, right, should only determine the taxation for the conversion in that year. So in other words, all those years should be all wrapped up into that one 8606. So if you contributed 2001 year, the total amount of non-deductible contributions that should have been stated in that year's conversion should have been 6,000. That 6,000 is the only amount that is not going to be subject to the taxes for that conversion distribution in that particular year. So if you did it appropriately and correctly, then you should be good to go. There should be no issue moving forward.
Thank you. All right, jumping back. So definition for yes. PWCG is essentially traditional IRA with life insurance assets. So with that as the working definition, they're saying, so for those accounts,
is PWGC IRA, a company that holds life settlements? Is that what you're saying?
I'm not positive. They're saying it's a traditional IRA they have with us, with their wife, that has IRA insurance assets.
Okay. An IRA typically cannot invest in life insurance contracts because it cannot insure the IRA holder. However, there are some organizations that own life insurance contracts due to what we call a life settlement. In other words, the insured got paid a lower dollar figure for those, and it's brokered by a company typically, and those assets in turn are held under an IRA as an investment. So in other words, it's not insuring the IRA holder, it's insuring other people. If assets on those particular, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so then for those type of investments, JP, if I'm gathering this correctly, Margo, they said, yes, correct, life settlement, and we're custodying that investment. So for those investments, if their distributions are being triggered by the receiver in 2021, will 1099-Rs be filed? And can they just use a 5498 if the rollover to a traditional IRA is at another institution?
Well, keep in mind, an asset under a retirement plan, if it does pay the ultimate value of that life insurance, must go back to the IRA. Okay. If it goes back into the IRA, well, then there's no taxation because those are just considered earnings. However, if the IRA holder wants those amounts moved to another institution, they could do so via a transfer. And that will not trigger a 1099-R because the two financial institutions are saying that I'm moving from an umbrella of one type of IRA to the same type of IRA at another financial institution. I wouldn't bypass having those assets paid back to the IRA because you can transfer it to any IRA after that transaction does occur. And it'll avoid any sort of taxation.
Thank you. Margo, let us know.
It's similar to IBM stock. You hold IBM stock, it has a dividend. The dividend must come back to the IRA. And from there, you could sell the IBM stock, turn it into cash. You could actually move that cash to another financial institution. And if it sits in an IRA of the same type, no taxation.
So they say, so distribution can go back into Entrust IRA, then transfer to another IRA thereafter so as to avoid taxation.
When you say distribution, it kind of throws me off a little bit because in a retirement space, distribution means money's coming out of the IRA. If they're just saying that the insurance company insurance contract is paying out, the distributions from the contract must go back into the IRA, so therefore there should be no taxation.
And they say the IRA is in receivership.
Yeah, it should go back to the IRA.
Okay.
And if it does go to someplace else, we need to know that amount because we need to cut a 1099-R for that. Because if we have knowledge that amount left the IRA, then that becomes a distributable event. If it hits the hands of the IRA holder without coming through the custodian, and we need to know what that amount is, and a 1099-R will be cut one way or another. And if the IRA holder does not agree with the amount that was reported, they can file an IRS Form 4852 with the IRS disputing the amount reported. And then it's between them and the IRS to prove why they dispute the amount.
They said the receiver is sending checks directly to the owners.
Okay. Then Entrust will have to cut a 1099-R because the receiver is bypassing the custodian of the IRA.
Okay.
Because IRA assets, earnings must go back to the IRA, it's just that the receiver is not following the protocol on a federal retirement plan. If it's paid to the IRA holder, it doesn't mean that taxation is absolved. It just bypassed the arrangement to be able to report on it properly. A 1099-R will be cut.
Okay, so in that case, would the owner then put it back into the Entrust IRA, or can they transfer it to another IRA in their name?
Oh, they can roll it over within 60 days. They can roll it over to another IRA if they wanted to, as long as it's done within 60 days. Or if it's past 60 days and they fall under one of the exceptions to the absolute or the extension of the 60-day period, they can self-certify by telling the other financial institution, although this is past 60 days, I am able to roll it over past the 60-day period because of this reason. then the rollover could possibly still occur.
Mm-hmm. And then how, follow up on this, how would the IRS find out about the distribution if it was return, if it was a return of capital?
Well, the capital or the earnings are not, I mean, it's irrelevant. Because for losses and gains in an IRA are suppressed. So if it's a return of capital, it's still IRA assets. So.
Got it. Okay.
There's no delineation of earnings and capital. Mm-hmm. Because retirement plan assets have never been taxed before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Last two questions here. So when is it beneficial to purchase rental property using an SDIRA? Using borrowed funds. Long-term holding versus real estate investor doing flips. Which is best, whether using borrowed funds or all cash?
I can't tell you which one's better for you. It's really a tolerance for the IRA holder, because we cannot advise specifically on and say this is what's good for you. The only thing we can do is tell you what the options are of buying a piece of property. That would be something, if you really need specific advice to your particular situation, I would highly recommend to seek the assistance of a competent legal, tax, or investment advisor so that they can advise specifically for your circumstance. But obviously, if the IRA does not have enough cash in the IRA to purchase a property, an option to purchase a property is via what we call a non-recourse loan. That's an option. Is one beneficial over another? That's not up to us to answer. It would be up to you, the IRA holder, based on your decision, as well as any recommendations provided by other professionals, because we are not a practitioner. So that will be something to discuss with those practitioners.
Okay. Next question. If I take a distribution of real estate shares from a traditional IRA, will I pay taxes only on the current FMV? The quarterly dividends are distributed to a separate IRA account.
Any amounts that are received that is constructively received by the individual as a distribution from the IRA is the only amount that's going to be taxable. If you receive shares, what's the value of those shares at the time of receipt? That's the amount that's going to be taxable. If the dividends are paid to another IRA, well, then those won't be taxable because it's still under the umbrella of a tax-deferred account.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Regarding the COVID distribution, do I need to prove I have financial need for the money?
I don't believe you have to prove it unless otherwise requested by the IRS. Congress did put strict stipulations on who's eligible to take COVID distributions. It's not just anybody. There is an FAQ for COVID distribution relief for distributions from an IRA in the IRS website that stipulates who is eligible for those particular distributions. And if you are going to take a distribution for that reason, and I hope that you do qualify for one of those reasons, because if the IRS eventually says prove it, you have to be able to prove that you were affected and do qualify for that provision.
Great. Next question. Is there a mechanism for the IRS finding out that the distribution was made?
Is there a mechanism for the IRS to find out at a distribution? I didn't quite get the last part.
Is there a way for the IRS on their end, a mechanism being like, is there a method that they can go search and confirm that a distribution was made for any given account?
Is there a mechanism for the IRS to confirm that a distribution was only the 1099-R initially? Is the mechanism, that's why custodians require that all assets that another entity has control over needs to come back to the IRA first before any sort of distribution occurs, so that the proper 1099-R reporting is facilitated. If that particular protocol was intentionally bypassed and discovered in the event of an audit, then it's up to the IRS to determine what the penalties would be for bypassing that particular protocol of having it go back to the custodian.
Great, thank you.
Not just penalties, but taxation as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next question. Multiple IRAs being held by the same custodian, do they require individual EINs for tax filing purposes?
Multiple IRAs being held by the same custodian, do they need separate EINs
mm-hmm.
to file the 990T? Generally, yes. Just to be able to delineate which property it is. And the reason for that is if one IRA that holds an asset gets into a prohibited transaction scenario, only that IRA will be disqualified. Again, if you have multiple IRAs with different types of investments, and if one IRA engages in a prohibited transaction, only that IRA will get disqualified. Keeping a separate EIN for each one of those IRAs will delineate for the IRS that these are separate IRAs. If you hold one EIN and aggregate them, the IRS could look at all your IRAs as one big IRA that if one gets disqualified, they could essentially determine or say that all those IRAs are disqualified because of one tax filing.
Got it. So maybe to mitigate risk, that's a general practice that's employed?
Yes.
Got
separated.
It. Okay. Thank you. And last question here. What would you say, JP, we covered them in the presentation, but just to repeat the tax form numbers in kind of a quick, digestible way, what would be the form numbers they need to know? I mentioned that it's in the presentation PDF we're sending to everybody, but what are the basic forms that you would say like you must be aware of when you're diving into this each year?
Sure. From a distribution perspective, if you receive a 1099-R, pay close attention to it because dollars are leaving an IRA, which could be subject to taxation. The IRS Form 5498, which reports not only the fair market value, but also reports contributions. And if contributions are made, make sure that it is reported on a 1040 if it's a traditional IRA deductible contribution. And if there is no deduction taken, that an IRS Form 8606 was filed for that. If it's a Roth distribution and it's not qualified, the IRS Form 8606 must be filed as well, Part 3 of that form. If a person rolled over assets on a 1040, it should be reported on line 4A. And if it was rolled over, they should put rollover beside 4B. That also includes qualified charitable distributions as well as HSA funding distributions. If there's any sort of a contribution made to an employer plan by a self-employed individual, they need to make sure that that's reported on the IRS Form 1040 as well to receive the deduction. So those are the major forms, as well as if you, on a special circumstance, qualify for the COVID relief. Make sure to file the form 8915E to be able to spread out or ratably spread out the taxation of such distribution. That's kind of in a general nutshell what we're looking at in the tax related issues in 2020. And of course, 990Ts for IRAs that invest in assets that have trade or business income.
Awesome. I think that was perfect. And that wraps us up. So we are at the end of the Q&A. JP, if you want to take us home.
All right. Thank you so much for attending today's seminar. We look forward to serving you again in another ENTRA seminar. We hope that you found this thing educational and helpful for you. I know we received more answers than what the webinar provided. We do provide those particular seminars as well. Please join us again in another ENTRA group seminar. We look forward to having you again. Thank you and have a great day.